Conspiracies Worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 513, October the 4th, 1981. I suppose all of you are expecting a comment from me on the exhuming of the body of Lee Harvey Oswald. That's a subject that I've done many broadcasts on and was concerned about the coffin. I agreed with Marina that it would be, I thought the coffin would be empty, the gravesite would be empty, but there was a body in that grave, and Michael Eddowes, who paid for exhuming the body, is satisfied that it was Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald Porter, evidently, according to the news accounts this evening, is satisfied that Lee Harvey Oswald is buried in that grave, and they've already put the coffin back into the grave. For the time being, I'm going to hold my opinion until I see who the doctors were that did the process. Two doctors were brought in from elsewhere, from outside of Texas. This was on the cable television today, and I don't know who they were or where they came from. If one was Michael Bodden from New York, I'd say forget it. I don't know who they were. A female doctor from the hospital gave an interview to the press. But you remember how the doctors got up, the news media gave an account how Ronald Reagan's wounds were and the direction they were and how they sewed him up. This is the recent shooting in March. And then a day later, they changed the direction, that there was a ricochet and the bullet came from a different direction. And they told us that he was doing well when he actually was very ill, and had photographs of him walking with his wife when there are really tubes in him covered by a robe and a nurse holding him up. There have been other subterfuges, such as the devil charts of Martin Bormann in Germany, the Nazi who did flee to South America and is alive today. And the authorities satisfied both the Soviet Union and the United States that was Martin Bormann at the time. And just about 2 months ago, a dentist acknowledged the fact that he was to identify the bridge work in the teeth of Eva Braun, who died with Adolf Hitler, and these were her teeth, in fact, in the bunker. And he just said this summer that the repair work on those teeth was in Berlin at the time, and they weren't her teeth. I also remember the controversy I had with the Justice Department, the FBI, on fingerprinting the body that is allegedly Howard Hughes that was turned into Texas in 1975. And the discrepancies in the account of that body. So I want to know who did the autopsy, who were the doctors, and where did they come from? And then there was another question on my mind, because they showed the car, the hearse pulling up, and they went there approximately 7 in the morning, very early in the morning, and exhumed this body. And there was a picture of the hearse taking it to the hospital at Baylor University, the hospital, and the body was there in 3 hours of autopsy, then it was buried. At the time Lee Harvey Oswald was buried, there was a special bronze coffin, or a heavy steel reinforced coffin that weighed about 2,700 pounds. And over that, they poured, I forget how many pounds of cement. I didn't look up the figure before I came here. But Marguerite Oswald testified as a witness before the Warren Commission, why is my son buried under all of this cement? And there was an article in Life magazine on how many tons of cement or pounds went over the coffin to reinforce the fact that the coffin stayed as is. And it's interesting today that they just simply dug up the body and there was no cement at all. And the coffin had been cracked. There was water in the grave, leaking in the grave, and this heavy bronze or steel coffin was cracked. So where did the cement go, and why would they be talking about that 18 years ago? In fact, there was a question, did they need guards around the clock, three guards around the clock, to watch this body when it was in such heavy steel, reinforced steel, and there was the cement on top of it? And Earl Warren had said before the meeting of the Warren Commission, not the Warren Commission, but their private meeting in January 1964, the minutes of the meeting, that there was something on that body and the nation couldn't stand another shock. So I don't know what he was referring to. We might ask Gerald Ford. Of course, he's alive and prosperous and isn't going to tell us what that would be, for sure. But at the time, they were concerned. Now, there's also some articles that Officer Tippit resembled Lee Harvey Oswald. And, of course, they were both murdered on the same 2 days apart. Tippit November 22nd and Oswald November 24th. And I don't know whether it would be possible. I don't know if it would be possible to exhume Officer Tippit and see if that grave is empty, or in the process of 18 years, if there were any differences in the body and in the grave sites of these men. I remember Marguerite Oswald saying, this is back in 1970, that she'd planted a magnolia tree and some plants around the grave, and the headstone had been removed and the plants, and she was upset. So over the period of years, this body may be Lee Harvey Oswald's, the authorities say it is, and they may be satisfied, but as it stands, I guess I will accept it with a question mark, because I want to know who conducted the autopsy. That's the important thing. But if Michael Eddowes was in the room and believes it was, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald, then we have to accept that as the final conclusion. In the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they printed in their volume 11, page 444, several interesting pages of discussion of a member of the Warren Commission, Howard Willens. He was one of the lawyers who wrote to Mr. J. Lee Rankin, the general counsel. And he wrote him a letter July 21st. And this was just a month and a half before the Warren report was completed. And he had certain doubts about the way the report was going to be written up. And there are just several sentences in this letter that I want to read to you to let you know how I feel and how dubious I am about the whole machinery. He wrote in writing up, he was making suggestions and writing the report. He said, I have substantial problems with the section beginning on page 24. I would consider placing that section of Oswald's location in Mrs. Payne's garage in the first part of our chapter, dealing with Oswald's ownership and conditional possession of that rifle. Oswald had allegedly had a rifle that was supposed to have been in Michael and Ruth Payne's garage, and he allegedly took it to the Texas Book Depository the day of the assassination, although nobody saw him hold a rifle or bring it into the building or leave the house with the rifle. So this member of the Warren Commission is having trouble on the conditional possession of the rifle. He said, I do not think that this discussion here is necessary to the argument that he carried a rifle in on Friday. He said that also the testimony discussed here is more relevant to the possession of the rifle as to the location of the rifle in the Payne's garage. He said, we do not have to prove that Oswald never took the rifle out of the garage in order to make the point that the garage was its usual storage place. So he was saying, we don't have to make the point. It's a conditional possession of the rifle. They weren't sure if he owned it, and they don't have to prove that he never took it out of the garage. Well, why wouldn't they have to prove that he took it out of the garage if it's the rifle that killed John Kennedy? But then going down in this same memorandum, this member of the Warren Commission said, I am of the mind now that there should be no other evidence section at the end of this chapter that they were writing about Oswald. I think the paraffin test, that's of his face and hands, should be set forth early in the report, after the discussion of Oswald's ownership of the rifle. And just before, and a few paragraphs above, he calls it conditional possession of the rifle. Then he said, it could be set forth by the commission in a frank statement that the Warren Commission has no scientific evidence, as opposed to eyewitness and circumstantial evidence, that Oswald fired the rifle on November 22nd. That's in 1963. The Warren Commission should put into their report, he said to the chief counsel, that they had no scientific evidence, as opposed to what witnesses said or circumstantial evidence, that Oswald fired the rifle on November 22nd. Now, this was written by Howard Willens to the chief counsel. He drafted this letter in July and sent it in August, and the Warren report came out in September. So they didn't have to say any more than a rifle had been in the garage. They didn't have to say it left there. If you wonder why I'm suspicious of the whole shenanigans through the years, that's just one example. When the House Select Committee was doing their work, I had a program on this station. It was October the 20th, 1978. It's tape number 359, Errors of the 1978 Investigation of the John Kennedy Assassination, the parts they carefully avoided. And I listed on the printed sheet that goes with the radio broadcast, the tape cassette, 19 major errors they made. But number one, numero uno, was the major error was the assumption that Lee Harvey Oswald was guilty when there was no evidence he killed John Kennedy or Officer J.D. Tippit. Now, the House Select Committee has printed, as I say, in Volume 11 of the new hearings, you can get that and read it, that the Warren Commission had no evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald fired the rifle. And then a year and a half later, on January the 5th, 1979, that was broadcast 370, there was an analysis of various researchers from the Assassination Information Bureau on what mistakes or omissions the House Select Committee made. And I put my critique down below what the others were saying. They were talking about the autopsy and Dr. Hume and medical evidence. They were centering in on the medical evidence. And my main criticism was they didn't prove that Lee Harvey Oswald received the rifle from Klein's mail order shop in Chicago. There was no evidence that he had that rifle or received it. And as I say, that's why I'm suspicious of the whole gang. Well, I have a pile of news articles here that could go on for 2 or 3 hours, but we'll take each one just as much as I have time for and hopefully get to the rest next week. But the news is pouring out. I thought for about 5 minutes each week I'd go back and do a little history lesson on what preceded the events that are taking place today so that you understand them more fully. And I might add, last week I mentioned that the House Intelligence Committee and the House voted a penalty and a prison sentence for people mentioning CIA officers or officials, either from past research or documents or present work. Even if we go back into history books, there'll be a penalty for naming agents. So what I think I'll do as soon as that law is passed is I just won't use the name CIA anymore. I'll just refer to them as Nazi collaborators. If I refer to Edwin P. Wilson or Theodore Shackley or Frank Turpel, I'll refer to these members of the crime syndicate or Nazi collaborators, because there's no law that you can't mention Nazi collaborators or crime syndicate members. So just add CIA onto that and you have the combine of the Nazis, the CIA, and organized crime. So I'll just leave the CIA agents off and we'll deal with them and refer to them as the syndicate or the Nazis, and you can just add that little third part to the triangle and know who I'm talking about, okay? The reason I say that is that Reinhard Gehlen, the chief of Hitler's Eastern Intelligence, formed our Central Intelligence Agency and came to the United States and then went back to be head of German intelligence, and all of the events taking place in the news today of major importance go back to that time in history. And therefore, if Gehlen and the Nazis made up the CIA, was the OSS before, and worked with organized crime and Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky and the mob and the Gambino family and the Genoveses and the whole syndicate, we'll just refer to them by those names. Now, part of our going back in history before we update the present are some very important dates, four important dates. If you have a pencil, write them down, and I'll give you the source. If you want the printed sheet with these, you can write to me, P.O. Box 52511, Carmel 93922, and I'll send you these dates. But if you have a pencil, write them down. On March 21st, 1943, Adolf Hitler gave a speech in which he intimated that it seemed that he couldn't take the Soviet Union or win the war this time around. He implied in that speech the Nazis will survive. The party leaders listened. They knew the war was literally lost, and all that they had to do now was to stall it until they got their money and organizations out of the country for the time being, until Gehlen and the other agents came back again and started all over again. The source of this date is a book, Kurt Rees, The Nazis Go Underground, how March 21, 1943, they set up the plants. The next date was 2 months later, May 16, 1943. This is again from Kurt Reese's book, The Nazis Go Underground. 2 months later, there was a meeting in Berlin of the Intelligence Department of the Gestapo, and they formed a new front. And Himmler's organization, Heinrich Himmler's organization, he was the head of the Gestapo, met in the Brown House, and they got out, which is published today, the Brown Book with a list of agents and where they went afterwards. They were called the Brown Shirts. They worked in the Brown House, and they had the Brown Book. And the Gestapo made their preparations for what to do after the war. And that's when the Odessa, the spider web that would cover the whole earth with the Fourth Reich, would proceed. And this is from Kurt Reese's book, The Nazis Go Underground. Then August the 10th, 1944, which was a year and 2 months later, Lieutenant General Scheid, S-C-H-E-I-D, met with the top industrialists and planned for all capital to be sent outside of Germany. This is in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, how all money would be sent out of the country and be put in neutral countries such as Spain and Switzerland and South America, wherever they could, in banks, so they would be ready for the Fourth Reich and World War III. These meetings were set up. And then October 24th, 1944, that's almost an anniversary. This is October the 4th. This is the date that I mentioned once before that was written up by Kevin Coogan in the newsletter Parapolitics that Jonathan Marshall gets out. October 24th, 1944, this was the time when there was a meeting, and the minutes of the meeting and the plans were turned over to the OSS, the organization that was our intelligence, that said that reactionary monarchist forces were working with the Italians, the industrialists, and businessmen, and they were planning their strategy and their new organization. They had the help of the British Universal Orient, that's the Masons, and the Italian Grand Orient, they combined. And, of course, this is the group later that were involved in the Masonic scandal in Italy and the shooting of Pope John Paul II. But these were the dates that these people got together and made a concerted effort, and people have studied this history and put these in different books, but they form a series if you read enough books, and I just brought a few of those. And, of course, that new book on Martin Bormann that I mentioned set up 750 corporations that would meet, that would be funded with the headquarters coming out of IG Farben and then the Krupp and the munitions makers and so forth to begin businesses and separate themselves from the Nazi Party, from Adolf Hitler, and start their businesses all over the world. Well, last week, September 23rd, that's a week and a half ago, there was a meeting in San Francisco. It was reported in the San Jose Mercury, and I wondered if this group, there were a corporate group of 500 people, are 500 of those 750 that were originally set up by IG Farben. There was an article, Hall Full of Solid Gold Equals When Stanford Research Session Convenes. It's a funny lead article. Hall Full of Solid Gold. Okay. San Francisco, in the red velvet gold leaf lobby of the Fairmount Hotel, the annual convention of Stanford Research of 500 of the world's business and industrial top executives. There was head of U.S. Steel, of Mitsubishi and City Corporation, the Japanese car firms, the Bank of Liberia, Edmund D. Rothschild, chairman of the board of his holding company in Paris, David Rockefeller, chairman of the International Advisory Committee and former chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, Akio Morita, chairman of the Sony Company, Sir David Orr, chairman of Unilever of London. There were four women there, one Swedish, French, and Lebanese, and they talked about each of their corporations. I suppose there were 500 of them. Invitations to these meetings are personal. They're not transferable. There are no assuming of invitations each year. You are re-extended only on the condition that you are analyzed, I suppose, each year, and then get another invitation. The keynote speaker was former Treasury Secretary George Shultz, president of Bechtel Corporation, who, of course, Casper Weinberg of the Defense Department, worked with Bechtel, and John J. McCone, former director of the CIA, Sir Michael Edwards, chairman of BL Limited, G. William Miller, that's Textron, and Bell Helicopter, he was former Treasury Secretary, former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and it goes on and on. British Steel, chairman of RCA, Mr. Bradshaw. It's a who's who of corporations from New Zealand and all over the world. 500 of them met last week. Now, I.G. Farben had the idea to set up 750 corporations, whale-heeled with billions of dollars, and get the businesses rolling and disassociate themselves from the Fourth Reich. One interesting corporation, the name came in the news a while ago when the human rights position was considered for Mr. Lefevre. He was working for Nestle Corporation. An article in the Examiner several weeks ago about Nestle's. Most people are surprised to learn that the biggest food company is not American but Swiss. And it goes into their food products. They sell $13.5 billion a year. They're a Swiss corporation. They have 5% holdings in Fort Worth, Texas, in the Alcon Laboratories. They have Stouffer's Food, Rusty Scoper chain, East European food chains, and companies in Brazil. It's all over the world. As I say, this is a large corporation, $13.5 billion. Companies in the United States and France and so forth. This is a large business. Headquarters in Switzerland, they're now supplying the Swiss government fallout shelters with 19 million cans of Nestle's ingredients. It's enough for a life of 10 years for the people in Switzerland. The Swiss government has ordered $19 million worth of Nestle's survival food. Do you think they know something that we don't know? It will feed the entire Swiss population for 3 days in the event of a nuclear attack. And most of the food that they're supplying the step will have a shelf life of 10 years. Nestle's has a contract for $19 million to provide food for an emergency for every person in Switzerland. So the lesson of history of warfare and so forth should be taken seriously as these people geared for World War IV. If you read World War III, don't let me jump that one. Some famous historians, Durand, said that World War IV will be fought with bows and arrows. And one last little lesson of history, because these early books or the current books written about the past will help you understand some of the news events that I give or throw out to you each week. They seem to rush along. Sometimes you can see the relationship and sometimes they appear far away or unrelated. But they all go back to these early intents of thousands of people. I'm talking about 10, 20, 30, 40,000 people that worked with Himmler, that left the country, that left with billions and billions of dollars of money. And then they parlay that into narcotics traffic and weapons and 750 corporations. And you wonder why, when you turn on the Sunday news, every single Sunday, Meet the Press, today it's a Saudi Arabian prime minister begging for weapons. Issues and Answers, Harold Brown from the Defense Department. Face the Nation, Casper Weinberger, Secretary of Defense. It goes on ad infinitum, and every week they put on United Technologies sponsors that program. One of them, Meet the Press. Alexander Haig was making $1 million a year from United Technology. These people are pushing for World War III, and if you think it's going to come out of a vacuum, forget it. It is carefully planned, and those dates I gave you are important to understand. And because I talk about the special forces and the Green Berets so much and the Nguyen Bank and the assassination teams behind events such as Jonestown, the John Lennon murder, and many other interrelated casualties that you will see in your lifetime, they will come out. I know they will, because after 18 years of studying the John Kennedy assassination, even the ABC News this evening referred to Oswald as the suspect in the Kennedy assassination. And CBS, after they talked about exhuming the body, said this does not end the case because they believe that other people were involved, more than one person. So anyway, going back to the Green Berets, because this is very important, and one of my longtime subscribers and friends reminded me of a chapter in the book Galen, Spy of the Century. Again, a very important book on the origin of the Special Forces and the Green Berets, because the Special Forces are the group that were over, and they're over the entire world and supplying Gaddafi with assassination and terror weapons and Idi Amin, and not only the left but the right and the middle, supplying the world with ways to kill and to bring these killings on faster. The Special Forces were the team in the Phoenix program in Southeast Asia that went into villages and huts and killed 20,000-30,000 people, women and children, to sweep them out just to make sure they, if I wanted one person, they'd burn the village down. Well, in the book, Galen, Spy of the Century, this is on page 240 up to 244, it tells how the Green Berets were formed. And in this chapter, it says Alan Dulles, he was the head of the OSS, working with Reinhard Galen as the war was winding down to get ready for the next war, III, that he didn't live to see. Dulles made it clear to Reinhard Galen, Hitler's intelligence chief, that top priority must be given to the selection and training of agents for work in Russia. They would recruit people from the Eastern European armies that had left the Soviet Union and were leaving communist countries, and they would train them. Their plan was not put into practice to make a special army until 1952, after the election of President Eisenhower was over and he eased out General Bedell Smith from the CIA and made Alan Dulles his director. Dulles had worked in the OSS with the Nazis, arranging for their coming to this country and all over South America. John Foster Dulles then was Secretary of the State, and the Dulles brothers believed deeply in having a private mercenary force set up in Germany, and they would call it the Special Forces. The Hitler agents were behind this. It would be called the Special Forces. And this book goes on to tell how this unit became the nucleus of the CIA's private army later, known as the Green Berets in Vietnam. Some of them today are stationed in West Germany, and of course they're stationed all over the world. And then this book tells how Galen and Alan Dulles of the CIA and the State Department chief, his brother John Foster Dulles, chose the men to head the Special Forces. They took three of Hitler's top Nazis, and these men, some evening I'll go into detail of who they were if you don't have this book. One of them was a Dr. Emil Augsburg, who worked in Poland, and by his own admission in the Gestapo, he helped Adolf Eichmann handle the Jewish solution and get rid of Jews. And after the collapse, when their armies collapsed, Hitler's armies collapsed, and Eichmann and he fled, with the help of the Odessa, that was their secret network they had set up 2 years earlier, they fled to Italy, where they stayed in charitable circles close to the Vatican, which helped escaped Nazis. This is written not by the Anti-Defamation League, but by Kukrige. It's called Galen, Spy of the Century. So that the men who were so wonderful at that final solution, two other head Nazis, that one worked at Dachau and near Munich, Germany, with Reinhard Galen. These people, three of them, helped ROSS and CIA set up the Special Forces. Now, in that same book, it tells how the Galen operation planned to starve 40 million Soviet citizens if they won the war against the Soviet Union and turn 50 million into slaves. So I refer to that passage many, many times. But if you think that they'll blush having a bloodbath soon in Guatemala, El Salvador, Cuba, forget it. These people have raped the world. They put in military dictatorships everywhere with the exception of Central America and a few isolated countries. And the background, or your history lesson for tonight, is how the Special Forces was started and the dates that these people met and got ready with their Odessa network so that they would have the money, the technology, and the intent to take the Soviet Union another time. If they couldn't win it that time, they'd win it again. And this time, they have the cooperation of 750 corporations they set up, plus maybe 500 more corporations that got their start through aerospace, through weapon manufacturing, through pushing a war which we were told was necessary. I'm going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll get back up to some more events of the news this past week.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.